dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The man who I have turned to for decades for his intelligence on one of the most important fronts in the war for the free world, namely the Middle East, is with us once again. He is Dr. Harold Rode. For many years, he was really the corporate memory of the Defense Department and others in the United States government on matters involving Turkey, Iran, the Middle East more generally, and particularly, I think, his insights into what he has written about for us most recently, the modern Islamic warfare, an ancient doctrine marches on, is extraordinarily valuable for understanding the challenges of our time. Harold Rode, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us. I think for the first time in the new year, happy new year as a result.
Same to you, Frank. Nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. So let me ask you first, Harold, about Turkey. This is a country you have studied closely, been to many, many times, and understand probably as well as anybody on this side of the Atlantic. There is now an active hostility phase, it seems, underway with the Turks attacking Kurdish forces that the United States has been arming and supporting in Syria. What is going on there, and what is likely to come of it?
Well, sadly, the Turks are doing exactly what you said. Let's say Erdogan and his forces, because the Turkish people, it is a little unclear where they stand. What we know for sure is that the Kurdish people have been a strong ally of the United States. The Kurds, wherever they are, admire the United States, want to be part of the American orbit. It is we who have at times pushed them away. Turkey is working with Iran and Qatar against the interests of the United States and its allies. And it is in Syria, it is supporting forces which oppose us. The odd thing here is that some of the forces that we are training in Syria are Islamic fundamentalists. No one looks at their flag in Arabic. It is our eternal leader is Muhammad. It's a flag. It's equivalent to the ISIS flag, but we refuse to see it. We should be supporting and working with the Kurds because they are the ones who are a strategic ally of the United States.
But those are the folks, as I understand it, Harold, that the Turks are most aggressively going after at the moment. They feel that they're separatists, they're the PKK, they're terrorists in their own right. So to the extent that this is going to play out with the Turks carving out, they say, a 19-mile buffer strip along their long border with Syria, that will displace, at the very least, if not actually in, result in the death of large numbers of the Kurds that you're saying we should be supporting. Is that right?
You're right. The truth is that the Americans are also supporting and arming the Kurds. We're in a situation where, look, they're proven allies. And we're also supporting people who are not proven allies right there. It's very interesting. This place is called Afrin that the Turks are creating this buffer zone in. And this area, which is going to be depopulated if the Turks get their way, is filled with all sorts of non-Muslim minorities. They're Yazidis, they're Armenians, they're Kurds. They're all the people who are natural allies of the United States. Now, Turkey was at one point a reliable NATO ally. But why is a so-called NATO ally working with the forces that in the end want to destroy Christian civilization of Europe? Why? It makes no sense.
Well, you mentioned, Harold, that one of the other things that the Turks are doing, which is very problematic, is aligning themselves with Iran, which is engaged in Syria, as you know, and elsewhere, and building a regional hegemony. Tell us the latest on the protests in Iran, Harold, and what is coming of them, if anything, at this point, and what we should be doing about it.
Two things. What is interesting is how similar that what we are seeing in Iran today is to what happened in 1978-79. I lived through a lot of this in Iran in 1978. And you'll find, we want everything to turn over tomorrow. A revolution is a process, and there's no doubt of the hatred of the Iranian people, by and large, for their government. They want nothing more than to be part of the international community, to be a respected member as they were before. And what is interesting is an hour ago, Vice President Pence spoke at the Israeli Knesset, and he one of his things that he mentioned is that we are with the Iranian people. We want you to be part. We are waiting for you again to be part of the international community. And we are, we need to help, basically, we try to inspire the Iranian people to help overthrow the government. Here's the difference between now and when our previous president, Obama, did. And how the Iranian people understand it. When Obama, in the past, when the Iranian people arose, the demonstrations in the streets, President Obama basically indicated to the Iranian people, we're with the Iranian government, we're not with you, the people. President Trump and Vice President Pence in his speech just now make it very clear, we stand with the Iranian people. I guarantee you, Frank, from previous experience, and if you look at Iranian history, they are looking for a strong power on the outside to give them encouragement. We don't need here in the United States to overthrow the Iranian government. The Iranian people do. And we give them strength, and we should be helping them in whatever ways we can. But we're not the ones that should go in and militarily take it over. They must own their own success.
Yeah, but clearly they need more than rhetoric from us. Is that not correct? What other steps could we be taking that would, you know, harm the regime and really penalize it for, you know, the repression that it's continuing to mete out to these folks? And to what extent is that repression now snuffing the protests in opposition?
From the way I see it, is the look at it like cancer, and that you've just gotten a cancer treatment on when we know that eventually there's nothing you can do on this particular type of cancer, and eventually it will kill the patient. This they're managing to snuff out, what make it appear like giving heroin. It makes you feel good for the moment, but it doesn't solve the problem for the Iranian government. I have been terribly wrong on my timing on when the revolution was going to take place. I have had no doubt that it's going to happen because I'm in constant contact with people who are inside the country. And you get this feeling from them, not what they say directly, but indirectly. They loathe the regime. They are looking for outside support. And believe me, it's good. It's very important that you and I and people like ourselves on a public forum never say how we are doing things. I'm sure, in fact, I am very sure that we are being very disagreeable in many, many ways to the Iranian regime. There's all sorts of indications that they're fighting each other. And again, as Vice President Pence made clear at the Knesset today, America is not going to sign another waiver regarding this, the Obama-Iran deal.
Yeah, the Obama bomb deal, I call it. Yeah. Well, that's good news, too. One other thing that we just want to make note of, Harold, is the vice president also said, I think to the delight of most of his listeners in the Knesset, that the United States embassy would be in business before the end of next year. This This marks a substantial improvement over what I understood the State Department was insisting upon, that they required 27 acres in Jerusalem and something like $1.4 billion. This sounded as though it was a prescription for there never being an embassy in Jerusalem. Harold, we have to leave it, I think, at that, but I do want to thank you for your insights into these various challenges. We'll look forward to tapping your brains on all of these issues, often in 2018. In the meantime, thank you for your time today. God bless you, my friend. Uzay Bulut joins us next, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined, I believe, for the first time by Uzay Bulut, a woman I have come to admire greatly for her writing, particularly at the Gatestone Institute. She is also a contributor to Clarion Project and to the Philos Project, where she is an associate fellow. She has been writing very courageously and thoughtfully and clearly about what is happening in her native Turkey. And it is of incredible importance, particularly at a moment when there is much in the news about what Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the now increasingly dictatorial Sharia supremacist president of Turkey, is up to. Uzay, welcome. It's so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we speak, the UN Security Council is having a meeting to discuss what Turkey is up to in Syria. And that's kind of a window on a larger set of problems. Of course, what the Turks are doing there is important, but I'm interested in what they're doing in Turkey and elsewhere as well. So start with Syria. Give us your thoughts on what Erdogan is up to.
Well, just yesterday, Turkey's Diyanet, which is the president of religious affairs, has declared that worshippers in mosques all across Turkey, and which is 90,000 mosques, and also in the Turkish-occupied northern Cyprus, will recite Quranic verses, which is actually the Surah Al-Fatah, which means verse of conquest, every day until the invasion of Afrin, Syria, ends. And they will be praying for the victory of Turkey's military operation on Afrin. So they are trying to excuse and justify and legitimize their military action on Syria, the Kurdish town of Afrin, with these jihadi or, you know, Islamic prayers. And so I would call their action or their invasion a jihad against the Kurds in Syria, which is extremely alarming. And so I hope the United Nations will make a just declaration or condemnation of this invasion.
Jose, what you just said is so important on several different levels, of course. Much of what Erdogan is doing domestically and internationally now is increasingly dressed up as product of what I think is best described as Sharia supremacism. This is certainly true of the actions he's taking in Syria. But talk a bit about the, well, I guess we might call it, according to Barack Obama, the fundamental transformation that Erdogan has wrought in your native land of Turkey.
Well, I think the biggest difference between Erdogan's regime and the past regimes is that Erdogan is now also openly targeting Europe and the Middle East and also the United States. Past governments were also very oppressive within the boundaries of Turkey. They carried out policies or some actions that resulted in the extermination of religious minorities in the country, Armenians, Greeks, Assyrians, and others. But their persecution and their oppression of minorities only targeted and very limited to the religious minorities inside Turkey. But now Erdogan, as a Sharia supremacist and an Islamic supremacist, seems to believe that he is an Ottoman kind of sultan and he represents Islamic conquest, the Islam's flag of conquest. That's why he openly targets Syria, Iraq, and it's, you know, for example, it is an very well known fact that Turkey has provided military and financial aid for the Islamic terror organizations in Iraq and Syria. Turkey has allowed Yazidi girls and women to be sold in offices in Southeast Turkey. So when we look at these things, what has changed? What is, I think, Turkey has been carrying out these activities and committing these crimes more openly. And Erdogan, unlike other government authorities, is more unpredictable and he is harder to control by the West. But former governments were also oppressive. They were also murderous against their minorities, and which has resulted in the Islamization of Turkey, the full Islamization of Turkey. Right now, the population is 99.9 Muslim. And how did this happen? It didn't start with Erdogan. Turkey has been annihilating or forcing the minorities, religious minorities, to flee Turkey for decades. But what is different is Erdogan is a proud Sharia supremacist, and he doesn't hide that. Right now, for example, why are they targeting Kurds? In many of his speeches, Erdogan refers to Kurds as atheists, as Zoroastrians, and some other government officials, or the Turkish media, for example, continually refers to Kurds as Armenians or, you know, kafirs, infidels, stuff like that. So they don't see Kurds who request national rights as Muslim. They see Kurds as an obstacle before their Turkish and Islamic goals, Turkification, and, you know, their goals to Turkify and Islamize the entire region. That's why they are targeting Kurds.
As I've mentioned, and as you well know, Turkey still enjoys, despite these predilections on the part of its president and foreign policies that flow from it, as we talked about with Harold Rode again, notably with respect to Iran and Syria and the Russians and the Chinese, for that matter. Yet it is still considered to be a member in good standing of NATO. That's a problem in its own right. And then there's also the problem that you mentioned, the Diyanet. This operation now has a foothold in the United States. And I'm being told, and I'd be interested in your take on this, that it is increasingly filling something of a void to sponsor the Muslim Brotherhood's operations in this country and elsewhere, I guess, as well. But what are your thoughts on these two issues, NATO and Turkey's support for the Brotherhood here?
I think NATO and the West has carried out from the very beginning the appeasement policy toward Turkey, and this has never bore the intended results. On the contrary, it has paved the way for more disasters, more problems, and more human suffering. So Turkey's, for example, military and other support for the Islamic terror organizations in Syria and Iraq has caused thousands of people to flee their homes, get murdered, or sexually enslaved. So I don't get it. What makes the West believe that this appeasement policy will work out in this case? I'll give you an example. In 1955, Turkey became a member of NATO. Sorry, in 1952. 3 years later, in 1955, Turkey carried out a horrific pogrom against the Christians and Jews, Greeks, Armenians, and Jews of Istanbul. And tens of thousands of Christians and Jews had to leave Turkey for their lives. They fled. So in 1959, a few years after that, Turkey's relations with the European Union got started. And then in 1964, the institutional framework between the EU and Turkey was formally started. So, and then a year later, Turkey forcibly deported its Greek citizens in Istanbul. So we see a pattern here. Every time Turkey commits a crime, the West awards it. And then in 1974, Turkey invaded Cyprus, the northern part of the island, and still has been occupying it illegally. What has happened? Nothing. Turkey has been getting away with all of its crimes throughout decades. They know that they will get away with the invasion of Syria as well. That's why they don't stop and they continue. And now with a more Islamic and Sharia supremacist president, they now target the entire Middle East. They are trying to empower Hamas in Israel and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
This is a subject for a longer conversation. Uzay, we'll have to come back to you. Thank you for your time today and for the terrific work you do at the Gatestone Institute. Come back to us again soon, if you will, Uzay. Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin joins us next on the shutdown, readiness, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is great to have with us a man I admire as highly as anyone I know in Washington, D.C. His name is General William Jerry Boykin, Lieutenant General, United States Army, retired. He served with extraordinary distinction inside the Army for some 36 years, including in virtually all, if not in fact all, of our most elite special forces units, including as a founding member of Delta Force and its commander. He finished his distinguished service to the country, at least to date, as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence under President George W. Bush. He is a dear friend. He works these days as the executive vice president at the Family Research Council and is an extraordinary ally in the war for the free world, and I couldn't be more pleased to have him with us. General Boykin, welcome back, sir. Happy New Year to you.
Hey, the same to you, Frank. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Thank you, sir. Let me ask you first, General, to talk about what's going on. I don't mean necessarily in terms of the detailed mechanics, but just in terms of the impact on the morale and the, well, the fighting trim, I guess you might say, of the United States military as we go through this government shutdown that is impacting them, among others.
You know, Frank, anytime you go into a hostile environment, you go into combat, you go into conflict of any kind, one of the most important things to every soldier, sailor, airman, and Marines is to know that the people of America are behind you. And now you see that the people that represent us in Congress, the very people that are making important decisions that impact the lives of every military person, they are in such disarray that they have now, quote, shut down the government. That's very, very demoralizing. From a more practical perspective also, though, you know, you can't commit to any long-term programs. You're planning your strategic plans and the materiel that you need to execute those strategic plans. You can't make a long-term commitment when the government has been shut down, so it sets our readiness back and demoralizes our troops.
Yeah. And General, as a career military man, you've doubtless been monitoring closely what is the state of readiness of your service, the Army, and others. Do you share the sorts of concerns that we talk about a lot here, that we're in a desperate straits in terms of our warfighting capabilities in a dangerous time in our country's history?
Yeah, of course I do. Look, I think that you got to give Donald Trump credit that he released his commanders and let them go after ISIS and gave them rules of engagement that would support being able to do exactly what they've done, which is they have really hurt ISIS. They've set them back, but ISIS is not going away. That said, I think that you also need to reflect on the fact that our military is down to pre-World War II levels between sequestration and program budget cuts. We've got a military now that is not able to sustain itself, particularly when you talk about airplanes and ships and tanks and artillery and those types of major end items that require a lot of maintenance and a lot of spare parts. Our budget has not allowed us to have the spare parts and the maintenance capabilities that are necessary for total readiness, and that's why you hear reports, which are true, of having to go to boneyards or museums to get airplane parts to keep our current fleets flying. And look, I think Trump is very sensitive about that, and that's why he's asked for, I think, about $800 billion in military budget. But again, not only do we not have an appropriations bill, but we've got a government shutdown, which means you really have to question the efficiency and the focus of the members of Congress right now, particularly those on the Democratic side.
Yeah, amen. General, speaking of readiness of our armed forces, you have joined General Meese, former Attorney General of the United States, and several others of us late last year in urging the president to stay the course in terms of his efforts to prevent transgender individuals from serving in the armed forces, and specifically to get a stay on these various lower court rules saying that he has to begin admitting them into the military. That advice has not yet been taken, alas, but just remind us, sir, as to why it is important, as you see it, that those sorts of folks with gender dysphoria, as it's called, be excluded from service in the armed forces?
Well, the first question that Congress and the president need to ask himself before they make any decisions regarding the military is, how does this enhance readiness? Now, if you can't demonstrate that it enhances readiness, then you shouldn't do it. And nobody's made any case that allowing transgenders to serve would enhance readiness, particularly at a time like this when our readiness is already low due to budget cuts. You can't make the case. That's why it hasn't been made. You can't make a case that a person coming in the military that either self-identifies as transgender or has been diagnosed with gender dysphoria is going to enhance readiness when you know there's going to be a period of time that they're not going to be deployable because they're either going through some kind of surgery or they're going through part of their hormone therapy or they're going through part of the whole process. They're going to be out of the force. They're not going to be deployable. Show me how that enhances readiness. And that's what General Meese and I and a group of others have stayed very focused on. And quite frankly, Frank, you've been right in the middle of that and very, very helpful and quite aggressive on this issue. Nobody in America has a constitutional right to serve in the military. Now, I'm going to say that again. Nobody has a constitutional right to serve in the military. My son was rejected because at 12 years old, he took Adderall for ADD, and he was rejected for entry into the military services. So how can there be any equity in the fact that now someone can come in saying, I've been diagnosed with gender dysphoria, or I self-identify as a transgender, and how can they then get in the military knowing that they're going to go on hormone therapy, and at some point they're probably going to ask for reorientation surgery? That is illogical. It does not contribute to readiness. And this is one of those common sense things that took a lot of courage for Donald Trump to say, this is not going to happen. And now you've got judges, unelected judges, commanding our military because they just usurped the authority and the power, constitutional power, of the President of the United States.
Article 2, absolutely right. General, I mentioned that you served as a Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, and I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about perhaps the most notorious transgender individual in modern American history, Chelsea Manning, who has been pardoned by President Obama for the crimes that she committed to, did huge damage, as I understand it, to our intelligence community. Also, but I'd ask you to address the fact that Linda Sarsour, a prominent Sharia supremacist, has endorsed Chelsea Manning for her bid for the United States Senate for Maryland. Your thoughts, sir?
Keep in mind that Barack Obama pardoned him like his last week in office. He was into a 35-year prison sentence for the largest release of classified information in American history. Here's a guy that betrayed his country, a guy that after having taken an oath of fidelity to his country, he betrayed his country, and then he was pardoned. And now he's going to run for Senate and is being endorsed by the nefarious elements like Linda Sarsour, who would bring Sharia to America tomorrow if she had the opportunity. And this guy's going to run for the Senate. And this is what I say to people. Here's a guy Here's a woman, I'm supposed to call her. Here's a woman who took an oath of fidelity to the American Constitution and then turned around and betrayed it. So now this person wants to take an oath of fidelity to the American Constitution a second time. And I would ask, how did it work out the first time?
A very good question. General Boykin, as always, your insights as well as your leadership on all these matters is extraordinarily important and deeply appreciated. Thank you, sir, for taking a little time to talk about them. Come back to us again often, I hope, in 2018.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting, as we have the privilege of being each week, with Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving Asia, our economic and national security interests there, and what's happening that is likely to impinge on one or both. It is a delight to have him, one of the people that we turn to, of course, but so do others. He is a columnist for The Daily Beast, frequent guest at Fox News, the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you as always.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, lots of things to talk about. Let's start with the latest out of North Korea, Gordon. The South Koreans, of course, as we've discussed in recent weeks, have been responding to a sort of charm offensive, I guess you might call it, by the North. This is taking place most immediately in the context of the Olympics. What's the latest on that front?
Yeah. Yesterday, Sunday, a famous North Korean singer, who, by the way, is a colonel in the North Korean army, crossed over the demilitarized zone with six other members of her advance team. She's planning events at the Winter Olympics by her art troupe, which is 140 people. By the way, that's small. The North Koreans are sending 230 cheerleaders to the Winter Olympics. In addition, there's going to be a Taekwondo demonstration team and others. There's going to be a cast almost of thousands of North Koreans.
Cecil B. DeMille. How many of them are intelligence operatives, would you guess, Gordon Chang?
You know, certainly there's going to be a number of them. They're probably not going to learn too much. What they're going to be is a lot of security personnel making sure that the other North Koreans do not defect. If one of them defects, it becomes a major incident for the Kim regime, and it becomes a major test for South Korea. Because if South Korea returns the defector, it really means that Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is on the other side. But if it keeps the defector, as it should, that would be something, because that will put the North Koreans on the back foot.
Now, we're told that there are going to be unified, at least one unified team with the North Koreans marching under some unification banner. Gordon, obviously, this is symbolism, but is it ominous in that it sounds as though President Moon, who many of us have thought is on the other side, is now beginning to be more, patently so?
This is actually, in general, a good news story for the United States and the international community. Now, the North and South Korean athletes, and there are very few, actually, North Korean athletes in the Games, but the few North Korean athletes will march with their South Korean counterparts under a unified flag. It's basically an outline of the Korean peninsula on a white field, and it has been used before, for instance, in the 2000 Summer Olympics in Sydney. What is for the first time, however, is that North and South Koreans will participate on the same team. It's the women's ice hockey team. Now, although more than 80% of the South Korean electorate wants North Korea to participate in the Olympics, more than 70% of South Koreans do not want this unified team. And the reason is that South Korean athletes who have trained for many years to be on the team have been turfed off to make room for the North Koreans. This has created outrage, not only among the athletes and the Korea Ice Hockey Association, but it's created outrage throughout society. And it's not just the conservatives who oppose Moon. It's also a large portion of Moon's base, the youngest South Korean voters, which means long term, this is a good story for the U.S. because it means South Korean nationalism is now stronger than Korean nationalism. And that's a really bad thing for President Moon.
Yeah. Gordon, let me turn to one other development that involves communist China. And you and I have discussed, it seems, for several years now, the inexorable advance of Chinese control of the South China Sea through the construction of and then arming of these man-made islands dotting it. One of them is in the Scarborough Shoals, and the USS Hopper, an American naval warship, did a freedom of navigation drill through those waters recently. Tell us about that and how the Chinese responded.
Yeah. On Saturday, China really went full bore against the United States because on the preceding Wednesday, the USS Hopper, which is an Arleigh Burke, went within 12 nautical miles of Scarborough Shoal. Scarborough Shoal is 124 nautical miles west of the main Philippine island of Luzon, generally thought to be part of the Philippines. China seized it in early 2012. That was a failure of the Obama administration. Now, this exercise on Wednesday,
which did not essentially respond to that provocation.
Well, it's even worse than that because Kurt Campbell at the State Department actually brokered a deal between Manila and Beijing for both sides to withdraw their craft from Scarborough. They had swarmed the shoal in early 2012. Only the Philippines complied, leaving the Chinese in control, and the U.S. did nothing about it. This is the Sudetenland on a smaller scale. Now, the Trump administration is compounding the error. They said that Wednesday's exercise was an innocent passage. An innocent passage is an acknowledgement that Scarborough Shoal is Chinese. This is horrible. Although maybe not as bad as what the Obama administration did in 2012, it is also feeble. And so, you know, Frank, I don't think that China's takeover of the South China Sea is inexorable by any means, but it is inexorable if there is atrocious policy on the part of successive American administrations. And indeed, that's the case right now. We do not have the United States opposing China with the vigor that is necessary. And that is not just an Obama problem. It's a Trump problem as well. Now, I know there are a lot of problems in the world that the Trump administration needs to deal with, but we're the United States of America. We're the guarantors of security, and we're letting the international system fall apart. So this is not a story of Chinese aggression. Yeah, the Chinese are aggressive. This is primarily a story of American feebleness.
And Gordon, just to be complete here, what was the nature of the full bore response by China to this action, innocent passage, as you say, rather than freedom of navigation?
Well, China said it was a violation of their territorial and sovereignty, which you could expect. They said we did not ask for permission. We don't need permission, whether an innocent passage or whatever. We did not need to ask the Chinese, even if Scarborough Shoal were theirs, and it's not, most definitely not theirs. You know, what the United States needs to do is to take an Arleigh Burke, perhaps supported by others, and go within 12 nautical miles of Scarborough Shoal with our targeting radar on, in other words, something that's incompatible with an innocent passage, to declare that Scarborough is not Chinese. And this is a responsibility of the U.S. And Frank, this is not just Trump officials. There's a problem at the top of the U.S. Navy. You have many flag officers who've taken position that essentially the United States is not going to effectively challenge China. You know, fortunately, we have the commander of Pacific Command, Admiral Harris, who's taken a very resolute view on this, but he is only one flag officer in a large Navy. We need other officers who also will challenge China to the full extent of our capabilities.
Amen. And we need them to be equipped as well as led to do just that. Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your time today. As always, we look forward to visiting with you next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and keep up the good work you do at the Daily Beast and elsewhere. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.